Welcome, listeners, to episode 32 of Know Your Enemy. I'm one of your podcast co-hosts, Matt Sittman, and I'm not here with my friend Sam Etherbell. He's traveling this week, but we did record an episode for all of you, and I'm just going to introduce it quickly for you. Our guest was someone we've wanted to have on the show for a long time, Kate Aronoff. I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with her work. She's a staff writer at The New Republic and the author of a new book titled Overheated, How Capitalism Broke the Planet and How We Fight Back. Her work has appeared also in The Intercept, The New York Times, The Nation, Rolling Stone, and The Guardian, among many other outlets. And she's also the co-editor of a book called We Own the Future, Democratic Socialism, American Style, and the co-author of the book A Planet to Win, Why We Need a Green New Deal. We're mostly talking with Kate about her new book, Overheated, and especially the ways it overlaps with our concerns on the show, how the right wing has tried to deny or obfuscate the reality of climate change, how their strategies have shifted over time, and it's really drawn on Kate's thorough and incredible reporting. Reading the book in preparation for the episode, I really, really was blown away by how excellent her research and reporting was, and I learned a lot reading it, and I think all of you will really enjoy this conversation. Just to mention a few housekeeping items, as always, we're grateful for our sponsors at Descent, who are great to partner with, and we're especially grateful that they offer a free digital subscription if you subscribe to Know Your Enemy on Patreon for $10 a month. And of course, for $5 a month, you get access to all of our bonus episodes, which now means about two bonus episodes a month in addition to our two free episodes. Other than that, as always, the music on the show that everyone loves is by High Water. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. Our producer is Jesse Brenneman. He makes these episodes sound great, and it's been really great working with him. And please do rate and review the show on iTunes. Please consider supporting us on Patreon. And without any further ado, here's our conversation with Kate Aronoff. All right, Kate, welcome to Know Your Enemy.
So glad to be here.
Yeah, we're thrilled.
This was one, you know, we'd had kind of on the books for a while, so to speak, and we were waiting for just the right occasion, which is, well, you're about to publish a book called Overheated, How Capitalism Broke the Planet and How We Fight Back. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the book in terms of when it's coming out, how you came to write it, and maybe, you know, what's distinctive about your book about climate change when, you know, it's a topic that is written about a lot these days.
Sure, yeah. It's coming out on 420, which was pegged to Earth Day, and I did not realize that books come out on Tuesday, so was going to be 422, is now 420.
Well, look, for our many listeners who live in New York, you can smoke a joint on the street reading Kate's book. You can even like walk by a policeman smoking a joint reading Kate Aronoff's book.
Yeah, that's the highest form of praxis I can imagine.
Yes, yes.
So the book comes out of roughly 5 years of reporting about as long as I've been sort of doing reporting full time. And, you know, I think the idea started to come together probably in the 2016 primary when I was first writing full time. My first assignment, like day two or something like that, of being a fellow in these times was to go to the DNC, which is like the most apocalyptic thing I'd ever experience.
up to that point.
Yeah. Truly just like a show of horrors in so many directions. But as a consequence of that job, you know, I was, you know, writing not just about climate, but also sort of this like fight within the Democratic Party. And, you know, remember kind of reporting these stories, talking to climate scientists, you know, about like, what does it take to deal with this problem? Like, you know, if you were to sort of design your ideal policy suite, what would that look like? And so scientists will just sort of very nonchalantly say, well, there can't be an internal combustion fossil fueled vehicle on the road. in the next 5 years. Things sort of to that effect, just to say very nonchalantly that like everything about the way we live has to, you know, change in some dramatic way. Not necessarily like people's lived experience, but, you know, what turns the lights on, how you cook food, all of these like really deep transformative changes to the way society is structured. So I would have these conversations and then, you know, look at kind of what was happening in the political debate and just, you know, there was such a gap between what was coming out from people who, you know, earnestly, I think have, you know, good intentions of wanting to deal with the climate crisis. And that, you know, total gap was just really wild. And I think was, you know, that was more interesting to me, I think, than some of the debate that had been sort of happening up to that point about, you know, do you believe in climate change or not, right? Because like climate denial has been such a fixture of US politics in particular. That has been the relevant question. That has been sort of what the climate debate has revolved around is, you know, do you think this is happening or not? But, you know, looking at that gap between kind of what a reasonable response would look like and what was sort of on the table politically brought up some, I think, more interesting questions for me personally. And like going to things like the UN climate talks for a couple of years in a row. I went to Paris in 2015 and then to a few different ones since then. There's a very different conversation happening in very different parts of the world. And sort of once you take climate denial outright off the table, once you don't have people sort of saying, well, you know, maybe the sun causes global warming, or maybe it's like just the historical cycle, all these sort of lines that the denialists like to spout off.
Maybe it's good to have more carbon in the atmosphere.
No, exactly. Maybe it makes the plants grow. And global greening.
Yeah. So you've been on the climate beat now for over 5 years. What were you kind of expecting to find when you started on the climate beat?
Yeah, well, I'd been involved in the climate movement all through college. I worked on fossil fuel divestment starting my freshman year of college. You know, the conversation sort of coming in, I got to college in 2010. And the climate conversation really was like bike around instead of driving and turn light bulbs and recycle and compost and things like that. And that was, you know, totally infuriating to me and like sort of pushed me toward wanting to do things, you know, like labor activism and other things that seem more material. So I, you know, had a sense for some of the movement dynamics and that kind of corner of that work for some time. And I think was, you know, realized I was not good at organizing, was better at writing. So decided to do that. And kind of making that switch was sort of surprised just how basically right a lot of the really like crusty organizers were about the problem, right? And what's just become like manifestly clear is that people living with fossil fuel infrastructure in their backyards and like who are dealing with this stuff every day, by and large, you know, have a better sense for like what needs to be done about it. And that, you know, the sort of like think tank expertise was not that helpful. And that's not to say, you know, I think there's been a lot of change in the way the climate movement operates in the last several years. And I do think there is more nuance often than that comes out of, you know, kind of lefty organizing spaces, of course, but on a sort of basic level, like the sort of core of the analysis holds up, I think, that like the fossil fuel industry is a phenomenally bad actor, is, you know, made up of the scum of the earth and cannot exist in order to deal with this crisis in any sort of like reasonable or rational way.
Yeah, that's a funny kind of flip of the way there's some sort of conventional stories about what happens when you're like move from focusing on activism to looking at like, well, what's really going on under the hood here in DC and in the back room, blah blah blah. And it's like, oh no. my socialist and anarchist friends doing sit-ins have a totally satisfactory analysis of what's going on here.
You know, Sam, it's kind of funny that that's come up on the show a couple times. I was thinking of when we were talking about Supreme Court decisions, with the 5 to 4 podcast. And that was one of their comments was that, you know, your average person on the street looks at a Supreme Court decision, looks at who it helps and who it hurts and says, hey, that doesn't seem right. And, but you know, it's the legal commentariat and, you know, law professors that kind of mystify these things in complexity and shades of gray and wringing their hands over trade-offs and this and that. But it seems like, yeah, you know, in this case too, as you're describing, ordinary people have a better sense of the stakes than people in a sense paid to find complexity where there might not actually be as much as yeah. They think.
There's definitely there's complex interests involved.
Yes.
But this, uh-huh. But the problem itself
yes
is not maybe as complicated as people whose salary depends on it being complicated.
Yeah.
Say uh-huh. That might be a good place to pivot to sort of one of the first areas that we wanted to ask you about, because there at least has been a very concerted project in the final quarter third of the 20th century of powerful interests, including many powerful people that we talk about on this podcast a lot, of trying to muddy the common sense ideas that people might otherwise have. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about how the enterprise of climate denialism, as it did exist and still does to some extent, was sort of built, especially on the right, but not only.
I mean, because Kate, there's some familiar characters in your book.
Mm-hmm.
who our listeners will have encountered, the Koch brothers, James Buchanan, Law and Economics,
Cato really, Institute.
Yeah, Cato Institute, the kind of right wing world of foundations and think tanks and, you know, pseudo experts.
Totally. There's even, you know, Carl Schmitt in there. Later on, you know, not as much as James Buchanan and the Koch brothers, but he gets a shout out. Yeah, I mean, I think, as you mentioned, climate denial is a spectrum, right? I think the people who are sort of like the platonic ideal of climate deniers come up in, as you said, a lot of the same sort of think tanks and like institutional settings that you know your enemy listeners will be very familiar with. So I always sort of think of them as like the ugly stepchildren of things like the Cato Institute and the American Enterprise Institute. And there is like fossil fuel funding going into them. It's never an enormous amount, right? I think they're like large sums sort of in their own right. But, you know, this is funded by the fossil fuel industry to some extent and is, you know, supported by all sorts of nefarious interests in the way that, like, you know, the Chamber of Commerce sort of supports like business conservatism through the 20th century. So it's sort of part of that, right? And I think that's, you know, so often like the way the climate denial space gets talked about is sort of in its own terms. But doing the research for the book really found it, you know, I think it's sort of hard to understand, you know, the project built within right-wing institutions for minority rule, you know, furthering different types of white supremacy, and just, you know, minoritarian thinking. You know, I think these things all sort of come up together, and it makes sense to understand climate denial sort of within that frame. And, you know, really kicks off like as soon as James Hansen sort of gives his testimony to Congress in 1988, sort of saying that global warming is a problem. There are antecedents of that beforehand. I mean, Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway have the sort of like foundational text, I think, of climate denial, sort of tracing it back through fights for acid rain and
cigarettes
and, you know, even the Cold War sort of things. And so all these people are sort of, you know, they just jump between these like different grifts, essentially, of like denying that cigarettes cause cancer, fighting for really like hawkish Cold War programs and policies. And they just sort of, you know, hop between these things and almost none of this like crew of, you know, what is in reality like 15 dudes who are now for the most part very old, who like might have a PhD in like statistics or something, but to get trotted out as being climate experts and doctors and things like that. Very few of them have, you know, actual climate sort of expertise with a couple exceptions, but by and large are these sort of paid for hire actors who are trotted out. And, you know, like one of the guys I interview in the book, Patrick Michaels, who's a, you know, real veteran of the circuit, was on staff at the Cato Institute for a long time before being booted in a sort of like reorganization that I talk a bit about. He was at the University of Virginia, you know, and is like in that world, you know, sort of engages with Buchanan in, I think, pretty minor ways. There might be more that I didn't find, but, you know, they're in this ecosystem. And I think now especially are pretty sad and pretty demoralized about the state that they're in.
I mean, Kate, one question along those lines, just as you were talking about the fact that, you know, you can't really take the climate denialism, that part of the conservative movement, kind of on its own terms. They're part of, or it's a part of this broader network. And, you know, one of the things we talked about when we had Marshall Steinbaum on the show to talk about the Chicago School of Economics, and, you know, some of the case studies we looked at were things kind of, you can see how the playbook could be used for climate change too, right? Things like consumer safety regarding, well, cigarettes or pharmaceuticals.
Seatbelts,
you know, things that kind of are posing a risk to kind of the common good, to people's health, to the environment, things that carry risks that, you know, major financial and corporate interests, you know, don't want to bear the brunt or the cost of those risks or confront them or be held accountable for them. So I kind of wondered, you know, since it's kind of part of a playbook, what is the playbook? In that kind of early phase of climate change denialism on the right, what were the talking points? What were the kind of arguments they made to try to make people doubt that this was really happening, or if it was happening, that it didn't mean what the experts were saying? What were the arguments they made?
You know, I think the point is that they were never sort of pushing some alternative vision of what was happening to the planet. That the playbook was really lifted from the fight against regulations on cigarettes. And it was never to like put out some specific thing that they were arguing was reality, but to just flood the zone essentially with information. And so to just sort of, you know, present all of this information, which contradicts itself, right? I mean, you go to these Heartland Institute conferences and just hear totally contradictory things, like in different, sometimes in the same session. It's like, is climate change happening? Well, it is, but maybe that's a good thing, but it's not happening at all. You know, and just like this totally circular thing that you can't, it's useless to try to like find coherence in. And so that, you know, I think that's one sort of big part of it, is just to really like get as much information out there that, you know, really distracts attention away from kind of what's happening. And they were pretty successful at that, you know, for a long time. People were invited onto cable news shows. Very sort of prominent outlets would invite like climate deniers on to talk about both sides of the issue and you know, really confuse people about what was happening. And then, you know, there's this other sort of realm of stuff that they do, which is just kind of, you know, retail lobbying, essentially, like lobby lawmakers, make enormous campaign contributions, that sort of thing. One of the sort of interesting projects which comes up in the book and that there's been some really good reporting on is this thing called the Global Climate Coalition, which, you know, is sort of seeded by the National Association of Manufacturers. I think their early meetings are, you know, in their offices or like communiques go out in their letterhead or something like that. But is comprised of, you know, electric utilities, fossil fuel companies, car companies, really a sort of gamut of like classic, you know, business conservative players. And they go to the UN early stages of the UN climate talks and are just like handing out all this information, trying to undermine the processes of the UN and of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And they score some really big wins. I mean, they, you know, come back in the US, kind of what they're doing is convincing the Senate to make the Clinton administration withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol's process. And they win. They win that fight, and it like dramatically shapes every piece of climate diplomacy since then, right? It's the reason why the Paris Agreement looks the way it does, why it's sort of this bottom-up individual country level commitments rather than legally binding targets is sort of built around wanting U.S. participation, which has to mean that it can't be a treaty which requires a Senate confirmation.
Right.
So they score, you know, some huge victories. I you know, describe them in the book as being now like fairly marginal players, but you know, they really did make a lot of headway and, you know, set progress back an enormous amount.
Well, it seems like the actual like kind of quack figures who you mention are sort of like the ugly stepchildren of these more quote-unquote reputable right-wing think tank world places. They're able to punch way above their weight in America, it seems like. And it seems like one explanation for that is simply that the whole project, of which they are just a small and slightly embarrassing component, is one centered around giving corporations and powerful elites total impunity to do whatever they want, and any kind of the solutions to the problem that they're pretending doesn't exist would rely on undermining some, you know, as your book goes on to explain at length, some like basic assumptions about the economy and about the relationship between the government and the market and regulation and all these things, which are the meat and potatoes of the right-wing anti-government, anti-New Deal project over the course of the 20th century. So even if the climate deniers, these kind of hired guns, are cranks, their goals are very well served by the greater project that they're embedded in, it seems like.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
The other way in which they seem to punch so far above their weight is that even as everything that we're talking about is true, the Republican Party, until very recently, was really just fully on board with full-on denialism, right?
Yeah, I mean, and still is in a lot of ways. Like, I think it's there are stories that come out, I think every 3 months, there's some story about how, you know, some subset of Republicans are warming up to climate change and are about to introduce some, like, you know, whether it's the Trillion Trees Initiative or a carbon price or you know, some other policy thing. It's always just on the horizon, right? That Republicans are going to believe in climate change. And it just, you know, it hasn't happened. You know, I think there was a period in which it seemed like that might happen. But for now, climate denial somewhere along the spectrum is the party line of the Republican Party. You know, and I think it's not the sort of like same lines you would have heard from Cato Institute, Heartland Institute cranks 5 years ago, but the upshot is basically the same.
Right.
You know, I think the thing that's interesting that's happening is that like the Republican Party and like prominent, you know, the zeitgeist in the Republican Party is diverging from what fossil fuel companies are actually saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, exactly.
And they, you know, are the Republicans are saying things that the fossil fuel industry will not say. I mean, it really, you know, in any corner of it, especially oil and gas companies, ExxonMobil, which has historically been really, really sort of happy to fund climate deniers at different points in its history since, you know, the mid-2000s has really not done that.
Didn't Amy Coney Barrett's father work for Exxon?
For Shell.
Or for Shell, sorry, yeah. My mistake. Just wondering, just that crossed my mind.
Yeah, and so there's a way in which it's sort of spun out of control in this strange way. And I know, I think like probably like I can't see inside the head of like Exxon CEO Darren Woods. There's certainly like an upside for them in having the Republican Party continue to just block anything called climate policy, and they certainly continue to donate to them, but the lines are very different. Exxon is not towing the sort of Republican Party line about climate change.
Right. There's that moment in your book where I think it's at the Heartland Institute 2019 conference. Is that where you met Fred Palmer?
Yes.
In 2019, which was, of course, held at the Trump Hotel. and there is this kind of scene of these kind of like dried up climate deniers complaining about the fact that fossil fuel executives have sort of softened. And Fred Palmer, he used to work directly for an energy company, right?
For Peabody Coal, yeah.
He says at some point to you, I used to work at Peabody. I haven't changed. I happen to think more CO2 in the air is good and not bad. But you cannot find one executive at a coal company that will say that now. You know, and that's a kind of like sort of pathetic scene in a way. And he's complaining about how the money is drying up for the kind of full-on denial that they're doing. And he's talking about crowdfunding a venture on Facebook. But it seems to me also that these guys, even as they're not the hotness in the project of climate denial, capaciously defined, they still play this really important role. Like you said, it's kind of like for the executives, it's like, whatever, these cranks, if they're convincing enough like Republican voters or Republican politicians to go along with it, then fine. We don't have to have our fingerprints on it anymore. That's nice. But the other thing that you point to is, I think, even more interesting, which is the way in which at this point, the kind of idea of denial and the kind of like idiot denier is a really kind of like ideologically soothing fact for even kind of more centrist, liberal, or even center left climate voices in politics. Because it's like, it's still the case that you can be like, well, we believe in the science, and these crazy people over there, these idiots, these dangerous deniers of reality don't. And that's enough.
Right.
Yeah.
It kind of creates a boogeyman that's really useful for people who don't really want to do that much because it's hard and because it involves actually standing up to massively powerful corporations and capital in general. So, you know, having them out there in the world maybe plays this other kind of complicated role.
Yeah. And I think it just sets such a low bar, too. I mean, this was really...
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I mean, yeah. The Trump administration was sort of wild to watch. I mean, this process play out. Like, we believe in science gets like a line on those, what is it, like, in this house, we believe, whatever. Like, becomes like one of those sayings. Certainly during the Trump administration, this is true on other issues too, but anything that was not Trump was, you know, considered welcome, regardless of what it was, you know, regardless of what was actually happening. I remember going to the climate talks held in Bonn in 2017, which was the first, you know, set of climate talks since Trump had said he was pulling out of the Paris Agreement. And there were these like sort of elder statesmen Democrats who were just so, they were just glowing, you know, they're so excited. People like Michael Bloomberg and Jerry Brown to be like making this whole show about how they were, you know, the sort of moral conscience of America coming to show Europe that they were on board and, you know, provide global climate leadership and all these things. And, you know, they're on stage with like the executives from PG&E, from like these like companies, which are, you know, really not good actors in this space, not necessarily ExxonMobil or fossil fuel companies, but certainly, you know, some ghouls to be sure. Like Walmart, I think was there. Yeah, just, I mean, the bar has just been so low. And I think the Trump administration really, really helped with that. And just to, you know, just to say that anything called climate policy is good, we have to get it out, it's so hard to do. And just really like that conversation is just not one which is at all in touch with like what actually needs to happen, which is really, really sweeping transformation that involves, you know, a real challenge to very powerful industries.
Well, Kate, we've been kind of, you know, building up to this. What replaced climate denialism? That's kind of, you know, the early part of your book, that's sort of the focus, the shift from straight up climate denialism to something else. So what now is kind of the state of play? What replaced these kind of old school deniers that Sam mentioned are kind of the sad sacks of your book, lamenting, you know, that even the oil companies won't go along with their lines anymore. So what's kind of replaced that earlier denialism?
Yeah, it's a lot of things. I mean, I tried to follow the money and looked at what fossil fuel companies are doing, which is staking a claim to the conversation about what needs to happen about it. I mean, this was really picked up in the last year or so as it, you know, became clear that a Democrat was going to take over the White House. And especially, you know, with a Democratic majority in Congress, you have fossil fuel companies putting out plans that they're going to be net zero, that fossil fuel companies are sort of the actor that is indispensable to taking on the climate crisis, right? That like it is impossible to imagine not using their expertise, not using the sort of vast, you know, array of knowledge they have about the energy system to transition over to something else. And so they have been, you know, walking a pretty smart line in positioning themselves as good faith actors in the climate fight. That's not new, but is, you know, has really picked up in the years, you know, since the cap and trade fight, which was, you know, a sort of coming out party for that in the US, but is really dangerous, I think. And it's a similar strategy, right, to sort of old school denial, which, you know, is to say they will agree certainly that the climate is changing, that something needs to be done about it, that it is an urgent problem. Where the confusion lies and where they, you know, try to sort of spread around very sort of corporate friendly ideas is in what has to happen. And so we don't really know, right, is the line that, like, how to decarbonize sectors like steel and coal, you'll need us for a very long time. And we have models, we have, you know, academics that we paid to come up with studies showing just how long you will need oil, and sort of saying that the transition away from fossil fuels is this hugely complicated, impossible to understand thing, which is only possible if, you know, you have the sort of power of the fossil fuel industry behind you. And that, you know, gets them in a lot of rooms that they wouldn't be otherwise. And it's very effective, especially, you know, given how much money they have to pour into the political system, you know, how close their relationships are in, you know, even spaces like the UN. And that's a harder thing to confront if, you know, you have studies out of like Princeton or Columbia that are, you know, saying that we need fossil fuels for decades and decades to come. And there just happens to be a little Exxon badge at the bottom of the first page who funded the study. Yeah, I mean, I think it's working quite well. And it is still, you know, really a third rail to go after the fossil fuel industry.
I mean, I guess I want to ask one kind of follow-up question to that, which is, if that's what fossil fuel companies are doing, they're no longer committed to kind of denialism. That's not what they're funding. That's not what they're backing. And it seems like even some of these, you know, international conferences, you know, they're at the table, right? And, you know, you mentioned the report with the little like Exxon insignia at the bottom of the first page. So what has that meant for the right, especially in the United States? I mean, if the kind of fossil fuel companies have kind of moved on in some way or adopted a different strategy, what has that meant? You know, what's kind of the right's response to that shift been?
So I think the think tank space, I would say, has probably moved a little closer in line. You know, something like the American Enterprise Institute, which still gets a lot of money from ExxonMobil, they, you know, will say some of the more nuanced lines about, you know, say carbon pricing, which Exxon has supported for over a decade at this point. They'll, you know, that is the most efficient solution to the climate crisis, and anything else, you know, would be sort of foolhardy. So, you know, I think that the think tank space has moved a little closer, and you know, even Cato, I think, has dropped some of its more egregious climate deniers and shifted more in that direction. I mean, within the Republican Party, it's really interesting because you have some people who, we'll talk about innovation, right, is the big sort of more recent catchword, that we need to invest in things like carbon capture and storage, in nuclear power, things that, you know, I think there are totally reasonable debates to be had about, but that are, when they, you know, come from Republican congressmen who are getting oodles of money from the fossil fuel industry, they are not engaging in those debates in what I would call good faith. But talking about anything which is not climate policy, which is actually on the table, right? And so you can point to like R&D funding and planting a bunch of trees to say we care about this. We just think we need a pro-industry approach to how to take this on. And, you know, the Green New Deal, for instance, is just like a Trojan horse for big government and socialism. Mm-hmm. So that's one line. And there's, you know, probably like a Venn diagram with some people in the middle with the just total sort of culture war climate stuff, which is totally unhinged. I mean, it's like, and unhinged from, you know, particularly like the industry.
Exxon isn't like funding commercials about how they're going to take away your hamburgers and that windmills like will fuck up your pacemaker or something.
I mean, there is like industry funding behind it, you know, and there's different parts.
Yeah, there is.
There's different parts of the industry too, right? And so like, like there's the sort of big multinationals who, you know, are in regulatory environments in places like Europe,
Where they're constrained.
But you also have all these independent oil and gas producers who have like their own trade lobby who do fund right. some of this, like, you know, Green right. New Deal hamburger stuff.
And that's like kind of like, that's the funny thing is thinking about, you know, the war against the big industry and the big multinational corporations. But there's also this sociology of the Republican Party, which has a lot, in many cases, has a lot more to do with those small producers and their trade groups in terms of access, direct access to Congress people, and kind of the messaging that gets filtered out through that path, mm-hmm. which can seem kind of more, it doesn't have as many smooth edges as the message that comes out from the big, powerful companies that are operating in a bunch of different countries and trying to shepherd in the new future where they're still on top.
And I would include the Cokes in that too, just to note, you know, like yes. I think privately held fossil fuel companies are their own sort of breed. And like the Coke empire has been the like shock troops of fighting climate, anything called climate policy.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me like sort of thinking about this in relation to other kinds of discussions we've had about regulation and big industry and the right. It's always ridiculous when giant corporations propose to regulate themselves. Though, of course, that has been the norm in this country for most industries, including those that have a lot of bad effects on people's health and otherwise. But there's a way in which it's even more laughable, or ought to be, when it comes to fossil fuel companies, because it's not like the thing that they do. I mean, this is kind of slippery because, like, ultimately, what they do is precisely the problem. Like, they can't do what they do and continue to exist. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, you know, regulating on the edges some of the byproducts. You know, I just watched the movie, like, Dark Waters, mm-hmm. that newish Todd Haynes movie about DuPont Chemical. And, like, you know, they could have just stopped making Teflon. You know, mm-hmm. for that, mm-hmm. for the particular purposes of what that movie was about. The stuff that was in Teflon is causing cancer. Stop making Teflon. When it comes to the fossil fuel industry, they just have to stop doing what they do altogether. So, yes. like, regulating themselves, having them at the table, having them be a major player, not just a voice, but, like, you know, a huge player in making the decisions about what the future of their industry is going to look like, just can't work. Doesn't make sense at all.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's the sort of big lie. that they're trying to tell, right? Is that like they have a future in which their profits can continue on indefinitely, and that is a world in which we keep warming below 2 degrees Celsius. And it's, I mean, it's like a total fabrication.
Right. And that's why the sort of idea of the end of denialism, there's still denialism, right? I mean, it's yeah. like you said, a denialism is a spectrum.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
There's a line in your book that from the beginning that I think might help us pivot to the next part of the conversation. You say, an imagined enlightened future free of climate deniers could easily be shaped by oil companies, which help write the climate policies that should constrain them, and the right, which responds by strewing the world with fences and cages to keep out refugees from the climate crisis it increasingly agrees is happening. I remember when I was younger and I was like invested in sort of climate change politics, and I thought, God, I can't wait for the moment when all these people are shamed for having denied this scientific fact, and it becomes obvious mm-hmm. that they were wrong, mm-hmm. and there's this glorious moment that, you know, it's like a very young, idealistic, liberal perspective that there's like going to be some epistemological reckoning at some point down the line. but it seems
still waiting.
So much more clear that they're never going to say, okay, I was wrong. You're just going to blink, and then you're going to open your eyes, and climate denial is going to be replaced by precisely what you describe in that passage, a mixture of giant corporations writing quote-unquote climate policy and right-wing fascists building walls and building fortress states to protect their resources and deny security to the refugees of climate emergencies.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, like there's this just this sort of imagined future about going so hard after like climate denial proper or whatever sort of like imagined thing that is. And that's like, and then what? You know, and then what? So yeah. Everybody says they believe in climate change. Okay, well, you know, what's left? And I think looking at the Republican Party, it's like, okay, what if Josh Hawley enthusiastically says the climate crisis is a big deal? And we should deal with it. How do you think that gets filtered through to policy?
Right.
And I think, you know, white supremacy is way more core to the project of the modern Republican Party than climate denial.
Yeah.
By far. And it's just like, you know, it's just like way more central to the ideological project. And it's totally possible for me to imagine, you know, a Republican Party, whether it's in 5 years or 10 years and 20 years. I don't think we're like immediately on the precipice of this, but, you know, most young people believe in climate change. Some of those young people are Republicans, and it's going to get, you know, harder and harder to just deny that. And whether there is some like big mea culpa moment where the Republican Party comes out with a platform that says, you know, this is our climate plan or whatever. I mean, they've already been writing climate policy through, you know, regressive immigration laws, certainly, but, you know, also just trying to like restrict the ability of people who are like living fence line with fossil fuel infrastructure to be able to have a say over what happens to that infrastructure, you know, to restrict voting rights, for instance, right? And so there is like a lot of climate policy which is already happening that won't go away. And you know, the case I try to make in the book is that climate change isn't like an issue, right? It's not like a thing that people will have a stance on and a policy program around. It is the terrain of politics for the 21st century, right? Like this is the world in which we're living is one where parts of the country will become unlivable, where huge swaths of the world will probably be too hot to live in, where storms and floods will make it, you know, impossible for people to have a livable future. And there are policy prescriptions, you know, to deal with that.
Yeah, like, so what if Josh Hawley, even if there was a mea culpa, it wouldn't even matter. Because if you say like, okay, I was wrong, climate change is real, and I just read this study from this very progressive think tank that shows that like there's going to be this many climate refugees. Now that's going to be my number one issue. Mm-hmm. Keeping those people out of our country.
Yeah, and we already see shades of this in Europe, right? Where you have, you know, parties like even the National Rally, Marine Le Pen's outfit, which talk about not like rootless cosmopolitans per se, but people not being connected enough to the land, and that only like true French people are of the soil, and this, you know, kind of like nodding back to this blood and soil type stuff. Or, you know, like Danish social democrats who are passing just like horribly regressive xenophobic policy on the one hand, and then talking about how important the climate crisis is on the other. It's not like a strange thing in the world. It's like a weird thing in the US to think about, but you know, it's not unusual among, you know, among wealthy countries.
I mean, Kate, I think we want to drill down into this kind of eco-apartheid future before we get to anything possibly more hopeful. But I'm kind of wondering what the spectrum of possibilities you foresee is. If the kind of hardcore eco-apartheid, eco-fascism is kind of one of the looming, really terrible possibilities. And, you know, on the other hand, whatever the most hopeful, aggressive response from world governments might be, you know, on the more optimistic side, what are some of the like in between options, you know, like apart from the worst case scenario, apart from the best case scenario, what are people suggesting? Are they putting hope in, say, you know, technological solutions that will just kind of be able to come up with some fix that magically, you know, solves these problems? Are there other kind of situations where we do better on some things, muddle through on others, and it's kind of neither the worst case or the best case scenario? Like, what are the sort of range of the menu of options you give readers in your book?
I mean, I think we're really heading toward a gray area. You know, I think, as you mentioned, like there is a sort of like totally dystopian version of this, of eco-apartheid. You know, I don't think I wouldn't predict, you know, like in 50 years, the United States will look like Mad Max or something like that. I think within the US, it seems, you know, there will probably be some kind of policy response that'll just look hugely unequal, just in the ways that most crises that play out in the United States are distributed really, really unevenly. Mm-hmm. Huge parts of the country left behind, huge amounts of internal displacement without, you know, some sort of corresponding expansion of the safety net. Places like Appalachia or West Texas that just face, you know, real economic ruin as industries sort of close up. So I think, you know, just leaving people behind is very likely, leaving whole sacrifice zones.
Right.
That's a really troubling term, sacrifice zones.
I think it was coined by environmental justice scholar Robert Bullard. As a sort of longstanding concept in environmental justice that, you know, there are just like places that are a pretty necessary part of capitalism that are just there to accept waste, either, you know, accept waste or provide labor, and are not sort of considered as like within the political community that needs, you know, the same protections as other people. And that's, you know, that's very true if you look at like where coal plants are, right? Predominantly in Black and Brown communities. This already, you know, this sort of thing already happens, right? And so I think, you know, as the crisis gets worse, we'll play out along those lines. But honestly, you know, I think maybe the more troubling thing, which I think the debate about kind of vaccine apartheid has made pretty clear, is just having a totally sort of nationalistic approach to it, which, you know, sees the crisis as ending at the borders and sees policy responses as ending at the borders too. And as far, I think, as the climate conversation has come in the U.S., and I do think, you know, the Biden plan is certainly more ambitious than any other presidential campaign when he was campaigning and any other White House has really put out. It really is, you know, only focused on the U.S., and there is not a lot of attention paid toward what it looks like to be a sort of good global actor and change the sort of style of American leadership, which, you know, just projects U.S. dominance on the rest of the world. And so I think it's globally will just, you know, be... could be sort of hugely unequal if that doesn't really change direction. And, you know, I should say I do spend a lot of the book talking about how this could be a lot better. how we could take on the crisis in a positive way, you know. And then, you know, I think there is a totally possible world in which, you know, we sort of reevaluate national priorities and think through, you know, something that looks a lot like a Green New Deal. Provide, you know, a federal jobs guarantee, bring, you know, parts of the fossil fuel economy under public ownership, and create a sort of managed transition away from fossil fuel power. You know, I try to make that case, but I think it will probably be like some mix of all of these things. And I don't think it'll be like coherent necessarily. I think we're probably aiming for a gray area where some things will happen and those will be good, some things will not, which is sort of like an unsatisfying answer, I realize. but yeah, I think we're sort of aiming for the middle.
When I wrote about prison being built in Appalachia, mm-hmm. in Eastern Kentucky, and there was that just the idea of sacrifice zones came up because, you know, there's actually like a trend of building prisons on top of mountains that were flattened by mountaintop removal, mm-hmm. Coal mining, and then sort of like in the spaces around them also having dumps, basically. So in terms of like literalizing the metaphor of sacrifice zones, you're putting people who are defined as unuseful or dead labor alongside refuse on top of no longer useful and in fact probably poisoned land from extraction. And that's a pretty grim future for a lot of different places in the country. The other thing I was going to talk about, is just because it's also a preoccupation of mine, is the kind of lifeboat ethics and Garrett Hardin.
The one thing I'll say just quickly on that, we've talked about denial being a spectrum. And I think, you know, along that spectrum somewhere is this idea that like people are bad, right? That like people don't deserve good things. And I think the types of things Hardin says about lifeboat ethics really come out of that, which I think is, you know, why there are kind of lines about the climate crisis, not from climate deniers, not from like the industry or right wing, but, you know, even people on the center to left end of the spectrum, which is, you know, maybe like humans are just too irresponsible to deal with this. Maybe we're just, you know, constitutionally unable to imagine or to create a better world for ourselves, that we're just, you know, too profligate and wasteful and greedy and things like that. And I think that is a real slippery slope to lifeboat ethics, to just saying that like people are bad, my people are good, and we're the ones who should get to survive. You know, I think that's that's the kind of like, that's where that logic goes. And I think it's just really dangerous.
Yeah.
It's like Murray Bookchin used to call the ecumenical we, the idea that even left-wing environmentalists would say, oh, we have destroyed the planet. Mm-hmm. We have created this crisis. And you know, we are all to blame. But in fact, that's not true. It's not true at all. And as your book demonstrates, a few very powerful companies are most to blame for this. And certainly a few very powerful countries and their leaders are even more to blame than most of the rest of the world. We is often an ideological obfuscation in conversations about the climate crisis.
Yeah. And I went through a whole sort of like mental complex about using the word we in the in the subtitle of the book, and you know, tried to define the we that I was talking about as, you know, being an encompassing sort of multiracial working class that could take on the polluters.
Kate, speaking of a more capacious we, I did note that the conclusion to your book seems to be premised on us not all being horrible people, but it's called "We Can Have Nice Things."
Yes,
we can have nice things. So, what are the nice things we can have? What's the I don't want to say, you know, optimistic or even hopeful necessarily, but what's the future that you want the left to try to work for? What's the vision of an alternative that's not eco-apartheid that you lay out in the book?
I mean, when I think about like what I would like life to look like on the other end of an energy transition, you know, in like 10 or 20 years or something like that, or, you know, maybe even, you know, not so long from now, like I just think about days that I really like where I get to do things that I enjoy. And, you know, we'll admit that that's sort of specific to my own kind of view on the world. But in the sort of like era of the Green New Deal, you could, you know, wake up on a Friday morning. It's a 3-day weekend, as all weekends are. You can smoke legal weed if you want to go to the park. That's been the beneficiary of a lot of federal investment. You know, meet up with your friends who are also on 3-day weeks and who make, you know, enough money through their union jobs doing some kind of low carbon labor, whether that's nursing or teaching or you know, being a solar installer in a union apprenticeship program. Hang out for a while, maybe take in like a play that's funded by a federal theater project, and just get to hang out, you know, and, you know, take high speed rail to the beach if you want, drink natural wine that some vintner has been paid to, you know, grow while sequestering carbon in the atmosphere. I think, you know, there's just a lot of things that are, I think that's like within reach, right? I don't think that's like totally outlandish or utopian.
Right.
But is, you know, requires sort of redefining what pleasure looks like, redefining kind of what goals an economy is chasing that, you know, are different from the ones we have now and sort of like replacing this, you know, economic system, which has many more things wrong with it than the fact that it runs on fossil fuels, that it, you know, really does treat, you know, people and the planet as expendable. So, you know, and I kind of go into a couple more sort of detailed policy suggestions, but I think, you know, for so long, climate change has been framed as an issue of sacrifice that we need to, like, you know, tighten our belts and constrain our consumption and make our lives less pleasant in some way. But, you know, I think that's totally wrong. I think the Green New Deal is sort of a helpful reorientation of that question to say that it's not that we like have to all collectively give up the things that make our lives good. I think if you're a fossil fuel executive, your life has to change in pretty dramatic ways, certainly. But for most people on Earth, right? You know, I think the world in which we've transitioned off of fossil fuels and kept warming below 2 degrees looks a lot better than the alternative of, you know, keeping business as usual going, even as climate change is happening. It's not like we're going to stop climate change, but you can, you know, build a better world while the weather gets more intense.
Yeah, I feel like your book does a really good job of hammering home the fact that the things that people really truly value in life for a sense of pleasure and community and love are not carbon intensive. They certainly don't have to be. But it strikes me that the future that you lay out as a possibility, if we can win, is totally believable to me and not utopian at all. And it does not involve this kind of sense of collective sacrifice, really. It's not about like living a much worse life for most people in the country, with the exception of fossil fuel executives who should just spend more time at the beach. but the thing standing in the way is not our capacity to imagine that. It's not our willingness to give something up. It's just our capacity to build a sufficiently powerful movement to defeat the powers that be. Like, the tough thing is that, is the fight, and not exactly having a world that is even better than the one we have now in a post fossil fuel future.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the big problem is like the US is not a terribly democratic country. So there are all these structural barriers in order to like build that movement and translate it into meaningful electoral power. But I think the two really do beget one another. You know, I think it's a virtuous cycle, right? And this is, I think, a big lesson of the New Deal. It's like people like getting stuff, and if you give people stuff, they'll probably vote for you, right? It's like
that's true. Yeah.
It's not that it's automatic. Like, I don't think, like, if in some ideal world, like Biden were to pass, you know, a $16 trillion stimulus plan, does that automatically result in like a massive constituency for social democracy? I don't know. Like, I imagine it's a lot more complicated than that. But I do think passing policies which make people's lives better and letting people associate doing something about the climate with material improvements in their life certainly doesn't hurt the project of
building. More free time.
Right, yeah. Right. More free time, 4-day work week, legal weed, all this stuff. It doesn't hurt the project of building a constituency which can sustain electoral majorities for decades to come, which is, you know, what the New Deal did really, really meaningfully. So, you know, I think the two sort of have to go together. And, you know, if I had some like magical answer about what that looks like, I would hope it would have happened. But I think policy has to make people's lives better. And I had hoped that Biden would like put his face on the check that we got, even if it was $1,400 and not $2,000, right? You know, I think advertising like the things you're doing to make people's lives better is good. And climate policy has to do that too, right? It has to like say, you know, this 4-day work week is brought to you by the Green New Deal. This legal weed is brought to you by our collective national project to keep temperatures from rising above 2 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
No, Kate, that's such a good point. It's interesting. I've been reading Eric Rauchway's new book on the New Deal called Why the New Deal Matters. And he pointed out that one reason the New Deal has been chipped away at by the right is that the New Deal has affected so many parts of our lives that we interact, in a sense, with the results of the New Deal day in and day out in ways that we do not realize. It's, you know, he uses the old analogy of the water that the fish swims in, right? It doesn't know it's in water. And so we don't know all these great things that have improved our lives that are a direct result of, you know, federal policy in the 1930s. Yeah. And so I'm, you know, I think you're right that kind of attaching good things, things people want, to climate policies are essential. You know, you're right though, that people associate sometimes talking about climate with turning out the lights when you leave a room, recycling, not running the faucet too long when you're brushing your teeth, whatever it might be, right? These kind of individual changes to behavior. And I just wonder your sense as you reported on this book, as you look at public polling, like, do people still think of it that way? You know, like, is that association of personal sacrifice lessening because of something like the Green New Deal, where we have a more constructive vision of how climate policy could be, you know, not about sacrifice, but about change and building a better world?
I love the point in your book where there's like a personal carbon footprint calculator that's like on like the Shell website or something like that.
What's your kind of sense of the state of things in that sense? And again, maybe where that idea came from, speaking to Sam's point right there.
Yeah, I think the sort of fixation on personal responsibility is less than it was like a decade ago, which is good. I think there is, you know, a sort of growing sense that this is a collective project. I'm always unclear about how to read poll numbers. I mean, most polls will tell you that like a majority of people in the U.S. believe that the government should do something about climate change. I mean, that's been true for a little while, but, you know, I think people are like a weird, weird mix of like, of sure. beliefs about this stuff. And, you know, would probably say, yes, the government should regulate us. And, well, my neighbor doesn't recycle, so I just think it's hopeless. Like, there are probably plenty of people like that. But I think, you know, the public conversation certainly has refocused about, I think, you know, this being an issue of public investment. I mean, that's really been the message coming out of the Biden administration so far, is that, you know, climate change is a jobs issue. This will create a lot of jobs. This demands, you know, sort of big public investment. So I think that's all good. But I do think there is like a lingering scent of personal responsibility for this. And just maybe even more so, just a real skepticism about the ability of government to do good things. Or that, you know, that there could be a new deal. That something could sort of transform people's lives in the way that the New Deal did. You know, I think there is some sense that that's a historical relic and that, you know, the government just doesn't do those things anymore or shouldn't do those things anymore. You know, I think we're probably sort of moving past like the era of total like neoliberal skepticism about the role of the government, which is good. I think there are positive signs that like the direction of travel is good. I don't think we're out of the woods necessarily, but I think that's a big part of it. And there is like a way in which the sort of like basic neoliberal script about individual responsibility is really deeply worn in to a lot of people. And that's just like, that is ideology, right? That is like, you know, it's not people are saying like individuals are responsible, but it is just sort of like the water that swam in. And, you know, similarly that, you know, the government is kind of a burden or can't be a force for good in everyday people's lives. And I think that's, you know, that's the big thing that that really has to change. But yeah, I don't want to be overly cynical about that. Like, I don't think, you know, we're in some sort of like ideological doldrum. Certainly the way people think about climate policy has changed in a way that's not so hyper individualistic. But I do think it lingers in ways that are kind of worrying.
Sure.
Well, and also I think that the more people who read your book, Overheated, the more people will understand.
That's really the key. If everyone reads my book, yes, then we will be on the right path.
That is one consumptive choice we encourage people to make.
Look,
purchasing Kate's book.
Yeah, personal responsibility is bunk, but it is your personal responsibility to buy my book out on April 20th.
That's right. So we'll have links to that in the show notes. And probably by the time this goes up, the book will be out.
That's right. Thanks so much, Kate.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So happy to come on. Yeah, thank you so much.
And thanks everyone for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sweet.